The Joe Mason Show is on in 5, 4, 4, 3, 3, 2, 2, 1, 1.
Welcome to the Phil Mason Show. I'm happy to have you here. I've got a great show planned for you. Once again, we're going to talk NBA for the entire hour. Coming up later, Rush Olson will be here to talk about globalization and the NBA and the WNBA, taking the WNBA and NBA to all four corners of the earth. And he has an interesting plan, and we'll talk about that. And afterwards, Zeb Benbrook will be here. We'll be talking about the game being played on Thursday with the Atlanta Hawks and the Brooklyn Nets. Should games be played in Europe and overseas during the season? And we'll give you a little preview of what you can expect, you folks in London, on Thursday evening. But up first, the San Antonio Spurs are the walking wounded Spurs, and here to talk all about that, and hey, we might even talk a little bit about trading or signing Andrew Bynum. Please welcome from PoundingTheRock.com, my friend Aaron Stampler is in the house. Aaron, how you doing, man? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Couldn't be better. My voice is a little shot, but outside of that, it's all good. And I'm looking forward to talking basketball today. The walking wounded Spurs. Now, for fantasy people who are listening, this isn't a big hit. But for the San Antonio Spurs, it is. Danny Green is out for 4 weeks at least with a broken finger. What does that mean to the San Antonio Spurs?
Well, first of all, I mean, I'm not quite sure he's going to be out for 4 weeks because right after he had the injury, he put it out on Twitter that he expects to be back in 2 weeks. So maybe this is another case of the Spurs purposefully exaggerating the injury of a player to make it, you know, I guess seem better for the fans or maybe surprising for their opponents when the guy comes back earlier than expected. They've done that numerous times in the past for Tony Parker and Tim Duncan, where they'll say, like, you know, oh, they'll miss a month with a sprained ankle or whatever, when then Parker comes back in a week. I'm not expecting, you know, Green to come back in a week or anything, but it wouldn't surprise me if he comes back sooner than 4 weeks from the broken hand. As far as what it means, it really depends on whether anybody else goes down or not. Right now, they can afford to be without him as long as Manu Ginobili who just came back himself after missing a couple of games with a tight hamstring. As long as he and Marco Bellinelli stay healthy on the wings, and of course Kawhi Leonard, as long as those three guys are, you know, healthy and playing well, then they could be afford to miss Danny Green. But if one of those three guys goes down as well, then they're going to be really shorthanded on the wings.
And then what is their play then? What do they do when they're, if they become that shorthanded? Because Ginobili's hamstrings are kind of tenuous right now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was dealing with that issue all last season. And supposedly this year, you know, in the offseason, he worked to strengthen his whole body so that it wouldn't happen again, where, you know, he took working out a lot more seriously, you know, doing weights, eating healthier and all that. And, of course, you know, Popovich likes to keep his minutes down. But, you know, so, you know, all Spurs fans, you know, have to be having their fingers crossed and, you know, hitting wood, all those things that, you know, it was just a two-game thing and not something that will affect them all season long. But if they did suffer another injury on the wings, then they would probably be a little underhanded as far as size goes. They might have to play somebody like, you know, like a backup point guard like Corey Joseph or Patty Mills at the shooting guard a little bit, you know, give him a few minutes at the shooting guard. We kind of saw that last night where, you know, Corey Joseph played a little shorthanded, little shooting guard for them. And if it really gets desperate, they might have to give some guy like Nando DeColo some run at the shooting guard. You know, he's a little bit bigger. He's 6'4", but he's hardly played all season, you know, long. He's just buried at the end of the bench.
So they'll be all right as long as someone else doesn't go down. That's tough, though, because they have been limping lately. You know, the other day, I was listening to Jalen Rose's podcast he does for Grantland Sports, and he made the mention, and I thought I'd bring this up. We can talk about this, that if he were Andrew Bynum, he would want to go to the San Antonio Spurs. And here's the reasoning behind it. He said they're big man friendly, and they only need him for 8 to 10 minutes a game, and he only needs to grab 6 or 7 boards a night. He doesn't even have to score, but he would, because, like he said, they're big man friendly. What do you think about Andrew Bynum in a Spurs uniform?
I don't think it's a good fit at all. I for many reasons. Number one, I mean, the first thing you hear about Andrew Bynum is that he just doesn't love the game of basketball very much, that he's just, you know, in this profession for the money. And, you know, I think the Spurs want guys who want to be there, who want to play hard. And, you know, the systems they run, both offensively and especially defensively, are very complex, notoriously complex for a player to grasp right away. Usually, you know, when they sign a free agent or draft somebody, it takes them, you know, a year or two to really figure out Pop's playbook. And, you know, I don't think Bynum has ever been confused with, like, one of the, you know, a really intelligent guy as far as, you know, basketball IQ is concerned. And I just don't think personality-wise he'd mesh very well with the veterans on that team. I mean, the Spurs are a team that, you know, wants to win the whole thing. You know, that's their agenda. That's their only agenda. They don't really do drama or, you know, controversy over there. And Bynum has always kind of invited that, you know, from the media, you know, he's always been kind of a colorful character. He's made controversial statements in the past. He's rubbed people the wrong way, both teammates and opponents. And I just don't think he'd be a good fit for the Spurs.
See, I think he'd be awesome if he had his head together, because he would be just what the doctor ordered. Thiago Splitter's out. They do need a big man, and he could give them that 7 to 10 minutes a night. And he was doing all right with Cleveland. As far as loving the game, lots of pro athletes don't really love the game anymore. They're there for their paycheck. The problem with Andrew Bynum is he wears his heart on his sleeve, and you can tell sometimes he just doesn't care. But I heard Mike Brown the other day on Dan Lebatard's show, and he said Andrew was fine for him. He said he went out there, he did what he was asked to do, but it just didn't work out. And he said the thing that was missing wasn't as much the desire, it was the frustration that he had lost the explosiveness that he once had. Because if you remember, 2 seasons ago, this guy moved like a cat. You know, I thought we were seeing the second coming of Will Chamberlain back then. I really did. He was very quick and explosive, and now he's not. And I think a lot of that has to do with frustration. But you don't think that Greg Popovich and Tim Duncan and Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili can't keep that guy in line?
I mean, I think they could keep most veterans in line, but I just don't know if Bynum is wired that way to respect anybody. I mean, I don't think really even Kobe Bryant or Pau Gasol could keep him in line, or Phil Jackson. I mean, I think he still shot off and had his moments where, you know, especially in the regular season, where he just, you know, he took games off, you know, where he'd like Shaq, you could say, you know, he took weeks off at a time where he just mentally wasn't really engaged. I mean, you were right. At his peak, when he was, when his knees were good and when he was focused, he was one of the best centers in the league, if not the best. But those days are well behind him, and his knees are shot. And I think I have to disagree with you on the fact that I just don't think he was playing well at Cleveland at all. I mean, he was getting some rebounds and some block shots, but he was shooting 42% from the floor. And for a 7-footer who's not, you know, taking 3-pointers, who's not shooting, you know, far from the basket, I mean, all of his shots are from in close. To be only at 42%, it's just not really acceptable. It's not really productive. I mean, when you're a guy who's, you know, shooting from 5 feet and in, your percentages have to be a lot higher than that. For you to be an asset to your team.
Yeah, but a couple things, and you're right, but a couple things you've left out is, one, he was out of the game for over a year, and two, that's a guard-centered offense, so he's not even figuring into the offense, not like he did in L.A., so it was a big adjustment for him, and 41% is 41%, considering the fact that he did what he was asked. He still got a block a game, he rebounded, he got 5 rebounds a night, and he scored almost 10 points a game. He's not the star that he once was, but you don't think he can't come off the bench and help someone for a few minutes a night?
He might be able to help someone. I just don't think he's a good fit for the Spurs, who run pretty much a guard-oriented offense as well. I mean, they don't really run their offense around Tim Duncan. I mean, most of Tim Duncan's shots come from the free throw line these days, you know, with Parker kicking out to him on the pick and pop. So I don't think the Spurs have really run like a post-heavy offense for a while themselves. I mean, what Tiago Splitter gets when he's healthy, he gets those pick and rolls to the basket, you know, and what Boris Diaw gets, you know, he gets jump shots or drives to the basket. And, you know, and Tim Duncan gets those free throws. Like I said, nobody really posts up for the Spurs these days. I mean, once in a blue moon, Tim Duncan will do it, but it's pretty rare. And it's just not a post-up league for anybody that much anymore. And I think, you know, a guy like Bynum, his specialty, it's kind of like, you know, the days of the dodo, unfortunately. It's just post-ups aren't very emphasized in the NBA for big men or small guys.
Yeah, but they used to post up with Duncan, didn't they?
Back in the day, yeah, when he was like, you know, more
springy. He could fly and move, and he was like just a tank.
Well, he had 30 pounds more on him back in those days, dude. Now Duncan's a really skinny guy these days.
Right, that's what I mean. Well, Bynum's not a skinny guy.
Yeah.
I think Bynum would – I think – and here's the other thing. If they had someone – forget – okay, not Andrew Bynum, but someone like him with his abilities, you don't think that Tony Parker then would kick it down to him and let him post up on the low block?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's like, you know, you're asking for a supermodel at that point. You know, obviously, anybody would be interested in, like, you know, a young athletic guy who could, you know, operate close to the basket. But I just don't think too many of those guys are around. And Bynum doesn't really fit that description anymore because he's not young. He's not springy. And like I said, I just don't think he'd be a good fit mentally for the Spurs, if even more so than physically. I don't think the Spurs have really been, tell you the truth, I don't really think they've really been missing Tiago Splitter all that much. I mean, they are like 8-0 without him this season. And, you know, he's been great for them defensively. But Jeff Ayers is coming along pretty good for them. He seems to be picking up their systems pretty well. He's rebounding well. He's playing good defense. His hands are terrible. That's his one weakness of his game, like offensively. You know, every time you throw the ball to him, it's an adventure. But defensively, he's been a real positive addition to that club. You know, he's given them a lot more than DeJuan Blair ever did on that end of the floor, for sure. And per minutes wise, he rebounds as well as anybody in the league. So I really don't think they're missing Tiago Splitter in that respect. And I also think when it comes down to it, most of the contenders in this league are going to play small against the Spurs in some form or fashion, or just because that's their specialty. I mean, whether you're talking about Miami or Houston or Oklahoma City, I think a lot of these teams, when they, you know, down the stretch, they do like to play small. And so that takes Tiago Splitter out of the game anyway. So the Spurs might as well practice, you know, playing small, because they're going to need to come May and June. You know, and they're going to have to put either Boris Diaw at the four or a guy like Kawhi Leonard at the four. And, you know, Tim Duncan's going to be without Tiago Splitter when it comes down to it.
Well, I like Andrew Bynum on that team. If it were me, I would want to play for the Spurs. Now, you mentioned that teams are going to go small ball against San Antonio, and they do. Portland is not one of those teams, and I think they're going to miss Splitter or someone with his type of presence against Portland, don't you think?
I wouldn't be surprised if Portland went small down the stretch against the Spurs if they met in the playoffs. I think, you know, you put you take Robin Lopez out of the game, you put LaMarcus Aldridge at the center, and then you spread the floor with four guys who could drive to the basket or shoot. I think a lot of teams play the Spurs that way. I mean, even New Orleans last night, whether it was smart or not is debatable, obviously, but for three quarters they played the Spurs big, and then down the stretch, they played the fourth quarter, the entire fourth quarter, in fact, they played small against the Spurs with Anthony Davis at the center and then four shooters. And, you know, it didn't work out for them at all. But, I mean, that's what they did, and that's what a lot of teams do.
Well, they play Portland on Friday night. And the thing about Aldridge is he's flourished in the four spot. You know, when he doesn't have to play the five, when they got Brook Lopez, that freed him up. So I think they're going to start out big, and I think that's going to – cause the Spurs some problems. But here's the chance for the Spurs to get on the wood against a team over 500, right?
Yeah, they still need to get one on the board there, but they're 0-1 against Portland, they're 0-2 against Oklahoma City, 0-2 against Houston, 0-1 against Indiana, 1-1 against the Clippers, but the one win was without Chris Paul. But you know, the Spurs have gotten a lot of flack for their record against the elite. But I don't think they get enough credit for their record against everybody else. I mean, really, every game in the Western Conference is a potential minefield. You have teams like Utah, you know, beating Oklahoma City or beating Denver when Denver was on a five-game winning streak. And the Spurs against teams that are seeded 6th through 15th at the moment, so basically everybody below Houston, they're 18-0. And, you know, you're not going to find anybody else going 18-0 against those teams. So every game, you know, whether by hook or by crook, they've managed to avoid, you know, a loss against the middle of the pack or the lower, you know, lower end of the pack. And they're also only have two losses against the Eastern Conference, one to New York and one to Indiana. So overall, against teams that are, quote unquote, not contenders, they're 29-1. And, you know, if it was so easy to go 29-1 against those teams, then everybody would.
That's exactly right. I think that whole thing is overblown. I've said this 100 times. I'll say it 101. Anyway, great stuff today. Aaron, thanks for being on the show, man.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right. That was Aaron Stampler. And you can find him over at poundingtherock.com. Coming up next, Rush Olson and I will be discussing the WNBA and NBA expanding to the four corners of the world. And we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show.
This is The Phil Nason Show.
And it's the reason Al Gore invented the internet.
And we'll be right back after these brief announcements.
Do you know your fantasy sports? Would you like to make money at it? DraftStreet.com and The Phil Nason Show would like to help you get started making money playing fantasy sports today. And we'll even give you the chance to get started making money today for free. On me. That's right. All you have to do is head on over to philnasons.com or visit the show notes for this show. Click the Draft Street image at the top of the page and start making money playing fantasy sports at draftstreet.com today.
Riveting talk radio. Everybody
get up. People cannot get away from the internet.
Well,
now.
I think it probably comes from porn as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got to be a big, strong thing.
Oh, that's gross. That's disgusting.
And it freaks me out.
My cheeks are sealed.
We love talk radio.
Bend over, baby.
Do you see what I'm saying?
WeirdTalkSuperstation.com.
Better than sex.
I don't know how good sex is.
We're going to do a lot of drinking.
Talk radio. Bend over, baby. That was great.
Brewtown Sports is your source for Brewers news and notes. Join Mr. Brewtown as he keeps you up to date on all the happenings of your Milwaukee Brewers and Major League Baseball. Follow the show on Facebook and Twitter, Brewtown Sports. Listen 24/7 at brewtownsports.podomatic.com.
If you like baseball, you should be checking out baseballpodcasts.net. It's one of the best places you can go on the internet to listen to independent baseball talk shows 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on our radio player that can be heard around the world. So won't you tune in and give us a listen at baseballpodcast.net. You can also listen to the great Phil Nason show here. See you there at baseballpodcast.net.
Hi, this is Phil Nason from This Week in Tennis and The Phil Nason Show. Max Sports Channels offers the best in sports talk radio, as well as great music 24 hours a day. It's my daily destination, and I hope it's yours. The sports talk begins each and every day at 3 p.m. and ends around 9 p.m. Special programming on the weekends. And in between all that, the hottest music on the internet. That's Max Sports Channels. Make it your daily destination.
You're listening to AFR, the Armed Forces Radio Network.
And now, back to the Phil Nason Show.
Oh, you again. Welcome back to the Phil Nason Show. NBA expansion. People talk about it a lot. They talk about how the NBA can take their already global market and their global product and actually place it overseas in foreign countries. And joining me to talk about that, from Rush Olson Creative and Sports, please welcome Rush Olson to the Phil Nason Show. Rush, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
I'm great. Thank you for having me on, Phil.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You know, this LinkedIn thing, it's a beautiful thing, man. I didn't even realize it was, I thought it was a joke. And then I joined up and I hooked up with you and a bunch of other cool people and smart sports-minded people. So it's all good, man. I'm glad to have you here.
Thank you.
All right. Now, can you do me a favor and tell the listeners a little bit about yourself? What is Rush Olson Creative in Sports?
Well, we're a creative services company with basically a special expertise in sports, which is my background. So we do ad campaigns, videos. Basically, if it's creative and has something to do with sports, we like to think we're a good choice to do it. And so I ad campaigns, videos. I'm working on a couple of broadcasting projects. I've worked for sports teams and for rights holder stations. So that's kind of my background. Even did a little D-League play-by-play back in the day.
There you go. And you have the right voice for it, too. I'm jealous.
Thank you.
All right. So anyway, you wrote a blog post called Associating Internationally, an Alternative Strategy for NBA Overseas Expansion. And I'll leave a link to that posting in the show notes. So you folks want to go over and read that blog post in full, and I suggest that you do. You'll be able to get a better idea of where Rush is coming from. But let me ask you this. If the NBA were to expand to, say, Europe, South America, Asia, or wherever, where would the money come from to pay their players in a similar fashion as the NBA does?
Well, I think the big thing on that is revenue base. You'd have to have the revenue base there. And so what you'd have to look at the things that provide the NBA its revenue base. So you've got an arena, certainly, in the NBA. Teams make tons of money off their arena. You'd have to look at what that arena provides in terms of being able to have NBA-quality sponsorship, in terms of NBA-quality attendance. You'd have to look at television. Obviously, the NBA gets a lot of money off both their local and national television contracts. And so you'd have to say, okay, this entire pie is going to go up enough for everybody to justify that expenditure to move over to Europe or Asia or wherever they decided they wanted to go. And it's different. The TV environment certainly is different in, let's say, a Europe. Heck, I read the other day that we get to see more Premier League games here than they do in England because of the way the TV setup is. So you'd have to deal with that. You'd also have to deal with the geographic base, but basically you would have to figure out what the revenue base is going to be to support an NBA team or more than one.
That's a good answer, but it brings me to this, though. I don't know how many arenas you've been to, and you would say, let's say, for example, Europe, but traditionally they're a lot smaller, and the crowds, Rush, are like the average attendance for, say, example, in Greece is like 1,500 to 2,000 people. In Germany, it's around, I don't know, 6,000. Say, here, this is from Sports Business Global. And they say there's like 6,800 total seats. So you're going to have to find some arenas. I think that would be the first obstacle, I suppose, would be the arena.
I completely agree. And the number of arenas that even approach NBA capacity are, you know, maybe a dozen in Europe at the most. Then you've also got to take a look at what's in those arenas. Are there suites? Are there video boards that can handle the kind of advertising they need? Is there even an environment where you can bring that stuff into play? The arenas I've been to in Europe, part of the things I noticed was, you know, there's a lot of ways that whatever their capacity, they could be monetizing things that aren't done. And I think part of the reason any NBA presence might be welcomed in Europe is the ability to bring some of those ideas, some of the things that teams do over here that maybe some teams haven't done as much over there that would help raise that revenue. But the bottom line is you've still got, at the moment, maybe you don't have the infrastructure that you're referring to properly expand a true NBA team into those countries.
Yeah, and good luck convincing them of that, too, because, as you know, things are a little tight right now, especially in Europe and in South America. But let me ask you this, though. Let's say, for example, we've cleared that obstacle. Well, like teams like Oklahoma City, they've had to trade their players like James Harden because they couldn't afford to keep him. And that's just one example of several, as you already know.
Sure.
How would expanding to another continent make this more of a problem, or wouldn't it make it more of a problem?
Well, you know, I think there might be two sides to this. So on one hand, you might look at the James Harden situation, for instance, and say, hey, you know what? That's okay. There's a salary cap here, and that's a big reason why they made that trade. They didn't want to exceed the salary cap. And you know what? The pool in terms of how good different teams are going to be kind of evened out. Clearly Oklahoma City seems to have sufficient talent on hand anyway. You had James Harden go to Houston, and now you've got the two teams that are more competitive. And certainly one of the points of a salary cap is to keep your competition as even as possible so the different teams have the possibility to win. On the other hand, you take a look at that Oklahoma City market, and it might have some parallels to some of what we were talking about in Europe, in that it's one of the smaller markets in the NBA, and why didn't they want to exceed the luxury tax? Well, a big reason why they wouldn't have wanted to exceed the luxury tax is because the local revenues aren't there to drive it. They're not New York. I notice over the past few weeks that NBA basketball has returned to New York City, and so therefore they have an enormous, if they did decide they wanted to exceed the salary cap and pay a luxury tax, they've got the local revenues to do it. Oklahoma City and let's say maybe a medium-sized city in Europe, they might not have it.
Yeah, there's quite a few teams that really don't have it. Oklahoma City, though, they did things the right way through the draft. And it just became this situation where they couldn't afford to keep guys they originally drafted. They weren't seeking out new players. They
Correct.
Were trying to keep the ones that they had because they have no money.
And it had to do with, and that a lot of that has to do with market size and local revenue. An Oklahoma City market is never going to get the let's say the local TV revenue from the Fox Sports affiliate that even say the Dallas Mavericks do, just down the road, just because of the market size. I will throw out a wild card here, and this is something we see in professional soccer certainly and in other sports overseas, is the oligarch wild card. The Roman Abramovich, who buys Chelsea, doesn't care how much money he loses. He just wants to win a championship. And so I suppose there is the possibility that you could have some teams in Europe owned by people like that that might level the playing field simply through their own personal wealth. Is that a sustainable strategy for overseas expansion? Probably not, though.
Yeah, it'd be tough. Look at the example of the Brooklyn Nets. Prokhorov buys the Nets, spends $1 billion almost. And he spent his money in the wrong place. But we're headed down the wrong path probably here. But The NBA, it has a huge worldwide presence. If I showed you my stat sheet, it would trip you out from where people are coming from to listen to this show because we do talk a lot about basketball.
Awesome.
And it's second only in terms of soccer and team sports worldwide. How would the WNBA, for example, strengthen that presence? Because your idea was to bring the WNBA over.
Well, and that was the genesis of this whole column. And I did three blogs sort of on this theme, was that the Sports Business Journal had done a survey. And the respondents are going to be people in the sports business. They said, what will be the first U.S. league to place a team outside of North America? And the NFL was number one, the NBA was number two, Major League Soccer was number three. And that got me to thinking, all right, let's say these teams did want to expand their overseas presence or place a team over there. How would they do it? What would be a logical strategy? And so when I thought about the NBA, I looked at all the things that you just said, arena size, difficulty in finding the right ownership, cultural differences. I also looked in terms of the NBA, the men's side, at the schedule. You've got to play 82 games plus serious playoffs if you're in the NBA. That's a serious travel problem if you've got a team in Asia or in Europe. And so I felt like, and there's obviously not room to expand the schedule. You can't ask those guys to play longer season. So I thought, you know what, I'm not sure, at least at this point in the NBA's life, that putting an NBA team or a division's worth of them in Europe is the right way to go. So that got me to thinking, all right, well, the NBA clearly has an interest in expanding their brand internationally. What would be something else they could do to do this if they wanted to actually put teams over there? And so that got me to thinking about the women's side of that league. And certainly women's basketball has long had a professional presence in Europe. And it is starting to develop one in Asia. With the WNBA, you don't play 82 games. The WNBA, you play 34 regular season games plus a shorter playoffs situation. Players already are comfortable going over to Europe. And so I thought, you know what? What if they started this process with the WNBA? You could place some franchises over there. Maybe you affiliate existing franchises with the WNBA. Maybe you have a summer season that is the league in the United States. Maybe you have a winter season that is the league in Europe. And I thought that might be a possibility for establishing. Why would it be good for the NBA? You get the brand over there. You get it established. You get people developing loyalties in local markets. Then if at some point the economics make sense to put a men's team over there, you've already established some loyal, somewhat of a loyal fan base that could potentially be transferred to a men's team that moved into the same market. And you've established even more deeply than you already have all of your contacts, all of your marketing relationships, all of that stuff that a local team needs to succeed.
That's a good answer. That's probably the better shot of the two. But how do you convince, for example, the European owners to pay the WNBA and NBA players the same as their American contemporaries? Because, geez, I tell you what, they seem not to have a lot of money over here.
Well, if it were an NBA team, it would be, you'd have national and international TV revenue. And I think you'd have to hope that that increased enough to cover some of those costs. On the WNBA side, though, I think you might have more of an issue with convincing the players who are playing in Europe to take less than they already make. Reason being, a lot of the star WNBA players, a lot of the star American players and those from other countries can go to Europe in the winter and play those seasons for a great deal more than they make under the WNBA salary cap. The reason being, you've got some owners that are keen to win, keen, don't mind losing money, and are willing to pay them to do that. However, as noted earlier, I think that the oligarch-owned team willing to lose money is not a long-term sustainable thing. So my thought is the biggest problem would be managing a salary cap and getting the WNBA Players Association, who are in negotiations for a new contract right now, to sign off on it.
That's a good answer. Now, last question. We've got a couple minutes left. FIBA. In order for all of this to work, FIBA would have to be involved. And as you already know, they're very powerful in and of themselves. How do you get FIBA to work alongside with the NBA?
Totally excellent point, because that is one of the trickiest things. You've got to overcome potential territorialism. You've got to maybe overcome some egos. I think the biggest way you would overcome that is you've got to make them a partner. You've got to figure out a way to draw them in, convince them it'll be good for basketball. Let's face it, FIBA has a reasonably strong brand, but the NBA brand is the strongest in the world in basketball and one of the strongest in sports. FIBA manages the Women's Euro League. Maybe you make an alliance, explain to them how they can make more money off of it, and that's perhaps how you go about appealing to them.
It'll definitely be tough, because my next guest, he covered the NBA Finals,
mm-hmm.
but he tried to get a press pass to cover EuroLeague 2013, and they turned him down. And he went there on his own dime, by the way.
Wow. So Phil, someday I hope to be able to do some more of what I do overseas in Europe. And that's exactly the scenario you just illustrated is exactly one of the reasons why I think there's eventually an application for it.
Absolutely, and I wish you a lot of luck with that. Great stuff today, Rush. Thank you so much for being on the show with me.
Phil, thank you, sir.
It was my pleasure. Folks, that was Rush Olson, and you can find him over at rusholson.com. Coming up next, Zeb Benbrook and I will be taking a look at the game happening on Thursday night in England. And we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show.
This is The Phil Nason Show.
And it's the reason Al Gore invented the internet.
And we'll be right back after these brief announcements.
Do you know your fantasy sports? Would you like to make money at it? DraftStreet.com and the Phil Nason Show would like to help you get started making money playing fantasy sports today. And we'll even give you the chance to get started making money today for free. On me. That's right. All you have to do is head on over to PhilNasons.com or visit the show notes for this show. Click the Draft Street image at the top of the page and start making money playing fantasy sports at DraftStreet.com today.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of Mets Musings, and I hope you'll join me each and every week as I recap all of the comings and goings-on in New York Mets baseball. I'll have guests on from all across Mets Nation giving their insights and analysis on the New York Mets. And you can follow me on Twitter at MetsMusings1, as well as on Facebook. The group name is Mets Musings. So tune in weekly to the Mets Musings, available at MetsMusings.com, Stitcher.com, iTunes.com, iHeartRadio, and of course, BaseballTalkRadio.com, the home of great baseball talk shows.
Riveting talk radio.
Everybody get up. People cannot get away from the internet.
Well,
now.
I think, and it probably comes from porn as well. You
yeah.
know what I mean? That's got to be a big, strong big thing. Strong
oh, that's thing. Gross. That's disgusting.
And it freaks me out.
My cheeks are sealed.
We love talk radio.
Bend over, baby.
Do you see what I'm saying?
WeirdTalkSuperstation.com.
Better than sex.
I don't know how good sex is.
We're going to do a lot of drinking.
Talk radio. Bend over, baby.
That was great.
Stitcher Smart Radio is an award-winning, free mobile application that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. Now you don't even need a Wi-Fi or a cell connection to listen to shows like The Phil Nason Show. Never miss another show. It's real simple. Just go to Stitcher.com and download the free app today. And never miss another Phil Nason Show.
Hi, this is Phil Nason from This Week in Tennis and The Phil Nason Show. Max Sports Channels offers the best in sports talk radio, as well as great music 24 hours a day. It's my daily destination, and I hope it's yours. The sports talk begins each and every day at 3 p.m. and ends around 9 p.m. Special programming on the weekends. And in between all that, the hottest music on the internet. That's Max Sports Channels. Make it your daily destination.
You're listening to AFR, the Armed Forces Radio Network.
And now, back to the Phil Nason Show.
By the way, ladies and gentlemen, as always, this stuff in lieu of actual entertainment.
Welcome back to the Phil Nason Show. The Atlanta Hawks and the Brooklyn Nets are in London to play a game against each other, a regular season game, no less, in London, England, on Thursday night. And here to talk about that and a lot more NBA hoops, please welcome from WelcomeToLoudCity.com, my friend Zeb Benbrook is in the house. Zeb, how you doing, man? Welcome to the show.
Doing great. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It always is my pleasure having you here. I don't know about you, but I guess I'll just ask you first. What do you think about regular season games being played outside of American soil or even in a neutral site such as this? What do you think about all that?
Well, I think it's honestly really bad. I mean, I'm as for globalization as the next guy. I'm a huge globalization fan. I think that it'd be great if we could get the NBA teams and the EuroLeague teams and teams from other countries playing together in some sort of tournament of champions like they did back in the 90s. But having NBA teams going all the way over to Europe during the regular season is a terrible idea. I mean, we've already got the preseason thing going. We've got teams traveling to Turkey, to England, to China to whatever country you can think of that's interested in basketball. They're getting exhibition games and they're packing the house. Everybody's getting excited. But during the season, it's just too hard for these teams to adjust because, I mean, you've got to fly a transoceanic flight. And I don't care, how nice of a hotel you're sleeping in. I don't care how good your accommodations are. You're still going to be tired after you're going that far across time zones and your schedule's that messed up. You know, it's just a fact of life. I mean, I've done it both ways. I've traveled first class. I've traveled coach on the worst flights you can imagine. Either way, you're going to hit the bed really hard when you get to the other side. And in the NBA season, we already know that 82 games is way too much. I mean, they throw it all on there because they make money via TV. They make money via ticket sales. But guys get injured. Guys don't have time to recover. Guys are rushed back. You know, guys don't they hardly have any time for practices during the season. And I mean, it's ridiculous. It's just going to game after game after game. And, it's obvious these guys are having trouble handling this as is. So I think it's just really bad for the health of the players is what I'm thinking. And I think it's really bad for the it's just really bad for the competitiveness of the league. So I'm totally against them doing this regular season game over in London. Now, if it's in like somewhere closer, like Mexico City, I think that was a good idea because it's not that far. But I think London's just a little bit too far for this type of thing.
Oh, I completely agree. I think it's ridiculous. But that's just another bright idea from the soon-to-be-gone dictator of the NBA, David Stern. But honestly, that is a long way to go to play a basketball game. Okay, granted, they were given some time off. They only play one game this week. But come on, that's ridiculous. And, you know, when you talk about the Mexico City thing being a good idea, it was okay for the San Antonio Spurs. But it certainly, I would think that Rick Adelman and the Minnesota Timberwolves would have something else to say about that because they didn't like it at all. One of the things that I don't like about this, and it doesn't matter where they go, is that you lose a home game. And those home games are important. You know, guys are trying to get home court advantage, and you've got them flying 7 hours to England, and then they have to make the adjustment time-wise and the jet lag, and then the food. Well, they'll have their own chefs, I'm sure. But still in all, this is just a bad idea. And it's nothing against the people in London. But are they really that star for NBA basketball? I mean, really, we were on a station in London for 2 weeks, and they say, hey, no one was listening to it because it was all about the NBA. And I thought that was odd because there's going to be an NBA game in London because NBA basketball is so big there. It just doesn't make sense, man. This whole thing doesn't make sense. If they were going to play this, say, well, there's really nowhere to play it. There's no neutral ground for them to play. So they send them to England. Why don't they just let them have their home game in their own barn and do this stuff in the preseason? I mean, you could do this easily. You could gather up 6 basketball teams. And they do this anyway. And let them go over for 2 or 3 weeks. Play against some of the roadkill over there and take care of the business and get right without losing sleep and just being jet lagged and having to adjust their bodies to all kinds of things. That's one thing. But to do it in the regular season, man, oh, my own. I think David Stern needs his head examined.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the biggest mistake here, obviously the biggest mistake is going over there in the first place during the regular season. But the other big mistake, like you said, is holding it in London. Now, I think there's two reasons the NBA does that. The number one reason is they've got a big arena there, an NBA-capable arena. So they're thinking like, oh, we can have a team there because the arena's there and because the money is already there and blah, blah, blah. And they also have it there because they speak English. But as you said, we got kicked off the radio in 2 weeks. There's no basketball interest in London. I mean, I know there are some great NBA fans there, you know, but they're few and far between. I mean, you got to have this game in somewhere where there's basketball interest, like Spain or Italy or Greece or somewhere in Yugoslavia or Lithuania. But the problem with those places is that they don't have an NBA arena ready. I mean, Germany, I think there's one in Berlin and there's one in London. And that's what the NBA says are the NBA-ready arenas right now. But there's not big enough of an arena anywhere else to host an NBA match. So, I mean, you've got your answer right there. I mean, you just send them out for preseason games and stadiums that aren't big enough to hold franchises, and you generate interest, and you try to look for a long-term solution to where maybe you could have a European division or something like that. But sending them over for a regular season game just puts them, you know, between a rock and a hard place. I mean, like you said, they play one game this week, the Hawks and the Nets. But in the other weeks, they're going to be feeling the pain because for the 3 or 4 days they get off now, they're going to have to play back-to-backs. They're going to have to play 4 games in 5 nights. They're going to have really long West Coast road trips, and it's just not going to work out in their favor. So, again, you know, just a really dumb idea.
It absolutely is. You know, in Greece, they have the Olympic field house where they could hold the game. But then you got all these other concerns. You know, you've got security concerns. And security is not the same. You know this as well as I do. You've been over here. You know, security is not the same. And this whole situation is just really stupid. It's just Dictator Stern thinking he's some clever guy, and the reality is it's just another dud. And here's where the rubber meets the road, Seb. Darren Williams, our favorite player. But Darren Williams isn't even going to get on the plane and go. Now, he's injured, but he's supposed to be a quote-unquote superstar, and he's not even going to go. I mean, it means nothing to these players. If you polled the players, they would say, no, 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 we don't want to go.
Yeah, I mean, if you gave any player – I absolutely agree with you. If you gave any player an option to say, like, well, could you sit at home and rest, or could you get on a transatlantic flight and then, you know, practice over there, play a game, come all the way back over, and then get right back into basketball. I mean, in the face of that really hard NBA schedule, there's just, you know, no choice for somebody like Darren Williams who's resting his ankles. So it's, you know, it's going to be hard to draw fans to that game, but they're going to sell out every time, and they're going to say it's a success because, I mean, London is a huge, huge city, so they're going to be able to fill up the arena regardless with tourists and people passing through and stuff like that. But there's just not a market there, you know?
I wonder how many tickets there are for complimentary use only. And I wonder for how many for the sponsors, because they have trouble even with the tennis filling it up. And tennis is pretty big there. They have a hard time filling up anything that isn't soccer related over there. And rightly so. The NBA is not their game. And that's fair enough. But to send them to London? Good Lord. Ugh. But it is what it is. You know, it's a shame. But it's good for, you know what, there's a heavy American contingent there and a lot of people from New York, but the Brooklyn Nets aren't from New York. I keep trying to remind people, these are the New Jersey Nets. This is, you can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig. And this is a pig, the Brooklyn Nets. But anyway, we do have a basketball game on Thursday night. And because this show will air on Wednesday night, we can actually preview it a bit. And as you know, the Brooklyn Nets are my favorite team on earth.
Mm.
And they're missing some people. Brooke Lopez and Darren Williams are not going to be there. Now, a lot of people said if those two had to remain healthy and lead this basketball team, if it were going to go anywhere, and they seem to be doing okay without these two guys, what gives with the Brooklyn Nets?
You know, I think it's kind of an interesting story between these two teams because the Hawks lost Al Horford and they were still able to go 4-5 without him. So that's with them too. But if we're going to focusing specifically on Brooklyn, I think that the difference between now and the start of the season is that the team kind of has an identity and they found players where they didn't think they were going to find players. I mean, they thought that Jason Terry was going to be the guy who's giving them 30 minutes a game, getting them a lot of points. You know, guys like Andre Kirilenko, guys like Andre Blatch, they just thought they were going to get better contributions out of their veterans. But a lot of the veterans, I think that some of the guys just aren't as good as they used to be. Some of the guys are just kind of transitioning to becoming from good players to becoming role players. And it's kind of hard for them. But on the flip side, the Nets have found a bunch of guys where they didn't think they'd find talent. Sean Livingston bounced between a ton of different teams, spent a long time rehabbing that knee. I mean, I remember when he was playing for the Thunder a couple of years ago, he had a huge robo cast on his knee, and it really limited him. And then you've got other guys who've stepped up, like Mirza Teletovic. We've talked about him in the past. Awesome, awesome shooter. And you've got Alan Anderson, a guy who used to play for the Toronto Raptors, was actually a really big part of the Raptors' run late last season. And when you've got those guys and you've got the identity of going small against most teams and causing matchup problems, then you start to win games. Now, is this the championship-caliber Brooklyn Nets team that we thought we'd see at the start of the season, you know, when Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce came in? No, it's not that team. I mean, it's kind of just kind of a mid-range, good team, kind of at the same level as the Hawks. But That's basically why they've been able to good. They've been able to be good. They've established an identity, and they found players where they didn't think they'd find them.
You know, they sure did. Teletovic is playing really good. Andre Blatch is playing okay, too. And they knew he would be up and down, but the guy who's been kind of taking over a little bit is Joe Johnson. And we'll see how long that lasts. He's Mr. Clutch, though, man. If they're down by two with a minute left, look out, because this guy seems to find the bottom of the net. But, geez, and I'll tell you what. Sean Livingston could win the Comeback Player of the Year. Because kid, you know what? He had like you said, what a horrific injury to the knee. You know, when you have stuff like that, and he was something before he got hurt. It's a tough adjustment. It's a tough adjustment for Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce to be role players on a team with such inner drama. Okay, they had some drama in Boston with Rajon Rondo, but they could control it because it was their team. I'm not so sure this is their team. It's still Brooke Lopez and Darren Williams' team, but they seem to be better without those two. So who knows? But the flip side here, the Atlanta Hawks losing Al Horford, in the long term, that's going to sting them. That has to. He's their leading scorer. He is their leader. But they have had some decent outings from Paul Millsap, Jeff Teague, and Kyle Korver. Lou Williams is starting to feel a little better with his knee. You know, he blew out his knee horrifically as well. Another guy that's been playing pretty decent for them is Piro Antic. He's not doing too bad either. And Damari Carroll has given them some pretty decent minutes. He's starting, but he's given them some decent minutes. He's getting some looks at the basket. And that's a beautiful thing for them too. So it is what it is. It's a game between – if you're going to send two teams over to London, I guess these would be the teams you send, because you don't want to send the elite of the NBA over there and tire them out. But this is the type of ball they're kind of used to in their own national league. So all systems go.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a good thing that they that they sent two teams like this. I mean, I think it's going to be a little bit of an uglier game. It's going to be more of a tough defensive game. We saw these two teams face off just a couple weeks ago with basically the same roster things that they had now. Al Horford was out. Darren Williams was also out. And the Nets won a pretty closely contested game, but there were a lot of threes. The game was really slow. There wasn't a lot of ball movement, and that's just going to be kind of the type of game you see between these two teams, because both of these teams have kind of made a concentrated effort to go a little bit smaller and find their identity. But the Hawks are probably going to go down without Al Horford, because he's going to be out for the entire season. It's hard to say whether they can stay afloat, but we definitely know that they're playing at their max potential right now. I think that the coach did a really good job of getting all that he could out of their players, but the Hawks just don't have the top-level talent that you need to be an upper seed and be a real championship contender. But they could really beat anybody in the league if they, you know, get the right matchup and are able to shoot really well from three, things like that. So, I think it's going to be a really great game, but I would definitely have to go with the Brooklyn Nets, just because I think they're on more of a roll right now. I think that they're confident and better playing without their stars, and I think they've done a great job to find an identity, and their talent is just a lot better, and they match up really well with Atlanta. So I would go with Brooklyn tonight.
Yeah, I think I'm going to take Atlanta. And here's the thing on Thursday night, and only because here's the deal: the boys over in Brooklyn, they're going to get too much rest because the pubs close at 2 o'clock during the middle of the week, and they're just not going to get the action that they need and what they're used to. And it is what it is. I like Atlanta in this game. And, boy, I tell you what, you folks in London, you are definitely in for a treat. That's for sure. Zeb, thanks for being on the show. Great stuff today, as always.
Thanks for having me on, as always.
All right, that was Zeb Bedbrook, and you can find him over at welcometoloudcity.com. And that's going to wrap it up for today's Phil Nason Show. I want to thank all my guests, Aaron Stampler, Rush Olson, and Zeb Bedbrook, for bringing the NBA to you. Tomorrow, we're going to talk baseball. The Cincinnati Reds report is back. Brandon Crayling will be back. Alex Hall will be here with the Oakland A's stuff. And we'll be talking about Mike Piazza and more drama with Mark Berman. Until then, y'all take care of yourselves. Be good. And most importantly,
Thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you, my father thanks you, my sister thanks you, and I thank you.